Geekscape.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today's narration is the 13th one from Geoffrey of Monmouth's The History of the Kings of Britain. And today we're going to hear about Arthur's foreign campaigns. Arthur then began to increase his personal entourage by inviting very distinguished men from far distant kingdoms to join it. In this way, he developed such a code of courtliness in his household that he inspired peoples living far away to imitate him. The result was that even the man of noblest birth, once he was roused to rivalry, thought nothing at all of himself unless he wore his arms and dressed in the same way as Arthur's knights. At last, the fame of Arthur's generosity and bravery spread to the very ends of the earth, and the kings of countries far across the sea trembled at the thought that they might be attacked and invaded by him, and so lose control of the lands under their dominion. They were so harassed by these tormenting anxieties that they rebuilt their towns and the towers in their towns, and then went so far as to construct castles on carefully chosen sites so that, if invasion should bring Arthur against them, they might have a refuge in their time of need. All this was reported to Arthur. The fact that he was dreaded by all encouraged him to conceive the idea of conquering the whole of Europe. He fitted out his fleets and sailed first of all to Norway, for he wished to give the kingship of that country to Loth, who was his brother-in-law. Loth was the nephew of Sighelm, the king of Norway, who had just died and left him the kingdom in his will. However, the Norwegians had refused to accept Loth and had raised a certain Ricolf to the royal power, for they considered that they could resist Arthur now that their towns were garrisoned. The son of this Loth, called Gawain, was at that time a boy 12 years old. He had been sent by Arthur's brother-in-law to serve in the household of Pope Sulpicius, who had dubbed him a knight. As soon as Arthur landed on the coast of Norway, as I had begun to explain to you, King Ricolf marched to meet him with the entire population of the country and then joined battle with him. Much blood was shed on either side, but in the end the Britons were victorious. They surged forward and killed Ricolf and a number of his men. Once they were sure of victory, they invested the cities of Norway and set fire to them everywhere. They scattered the rural population and continued to give full license to their savagery until they had forced all Norway, and all Denmark too, to accept Arthur's rule. As soon as he had subdued these countries and raised Loth to the kingship of Norway, Arthur sailed off to Gaul. He drew his troops up in companies and began to lay waste the countryside in all directions. The province of Gaul was at that time under the jurisdiction of the tribune Frollo, who ruled it in the name of the emperor Leo. The moment Frollo heard of the coming of Arthur, he marched out, supported by the entire armed force which he had under command. He was determined to fight against Arthur, but in effect he could offer little resistance. The young men of all the islands which Arthur had subdued were there to fight at his side, and he was reported to have so powerful a force that it could hardly have been conquered by anyone. What is more, the better part of the army of the Gauls was already in Arthur's service, for he had brought them over by the gifts which he had given them. As soon as Frollo saw that he was having the worst of the fight, he quit the battlefield without more ado and fled to Paris with a few men left to him. There, Frollo reassembled his scattered people, garrisoned the town, and made up his mind to meet Arthur in the field a second time. Just as Frollo was considering how to strengthen his army by calling upon neighbouring peoples, Arthur arrived unexpectedly and besieged him inside the city. A whole month passed. Frollo grieved to see his people dying of hunger, and sent a message to Arthur to say that they should meet in single combat, and that whichever was victorious should take the kingdom of the other. Being a man of immense stature, courage, and strength, Frollo relied upon these advantages when he sent his message, hoping in this way to find a solution to his problem. When the news of Frollo's plan reached Arthur, he was immensely pleased, and he sent word back that he would be willing to hold the meeting that had been suggested. An agreement was come to on both sides, and the two met on an island outside the city, the populace gathering to see what would happen to them. Arthur and Frollo were both fully armed and seated on horses which were wonderfully fleet of foot. It was not easy to foretell which would win. For a moment they stood facing each other, with their lances held straight in the air. Then they suddenly set spurs to their horses and struck each other two mighty blows. Arthur aimed his lance with more care and hit Frollo high up on his chest. He avoided Frollo's weapon and hurled his enemy to the ground with all his might. Arthur then drew his sword from the scabbard and was just hurrying forward to strike Frollo when the latter leapt quickly to his feet, ran forward with his lance levelled, and with a deadly thrust stabbed Arthur's horse in the chest, thus bringing down both horse and rider. When the Britons saw their king thrown to the ground, they were afraid that he was dead, and it was only with great self-control that they restrained themselves from breaking the truce and hurling themselves as one man upon the Gauls. Just as they were planning to invade the lists, Arthur sprang quickly to his feet, covered himself with his shield, and rushed forward to meet Frollo. They stood up to each other, hand to hand, giving blow for blow, and each doing his utmost to kill the other. In the end, Frollo found an opening and struck Arthur on the forehead. It was only the fact that he blunted the edge of his sword blade at the point where it made contact with Arthur's metal helmet that prevented Frollo from dealing a mortal blow. When Arthur saw his leather cuirass and his round shield grow red, he was roused to even fiercer anger. He raised Caliburn in the air with all his strength and brought it down through Frollo's helmet and so onto his head, which he cut into two halves. At this blow, Frollo fell to the ground, drummed the earth with his heels, and breathed his soul into the winds. The moment this was made known throughout the army, the townsfolk ran forward, threw open their gates, and surrendered their city to Arthur. As soon as he had won his victory, he divided his army into two, and put one half under the command of Hoel, ordering him to go off to attack Guittard, the leader of the Poitevins. With the other half, Arthur busied himself in subduing the remaining provinces which were still hostile to him. Hoel soon reached Aquitania, seized the towns of that region, and after harassing Guittard in a number of battles, forced him to surrender. He also ravaged Gascony with fire and sword, and forced its leaders to submit. 9 years passed. Once Arthur had subjected all the regions of Gaul to his power, he returned once more to Paris and held a court there. He called an assembly of the clergy and the people and settled the government of the realm peacefully and legally. It was then that he gave Neustria, now called Normandy, to his cupbearer, Bedivere, and the province of Anjou to his seneschal, Kay. He gave a number of other provinces to the noblemen who had served him. Once he had pacified all these cities and peoples, he returned to Britain just as spring was coming on. When the feast of Whitsuntide began to draw near, Arthur, who was quite overjoyed by his great success, made up his mind to hold a plenary court at that season and place the crown of the kingdom on his head. He decided, too, to summon to this feast the leaders who owed him homage, so that he could celebrate Whitsun with greater reverence and renew the closest possible pacts of peace with his chieftains. He explained to the members of his court what he was proposing to do, and accepted their advice that he should carry out his plan in the city of the legions. Situated as it is, in Glamorganshire, on the River Usk, not far from the Severn Sea, in a most pleasant position, and being richer in material wealth than other townships, this city was eminently suitable for such a ceremony. The river, which I have named, flowed by it on one side, and up this the kings and princes who were to have come from across the sea could be carried in a fleet of ships. On the other side, which was flanked by meadows and wooded groves, they had adorned the city with royal palaces, and by the gold-painted gables of its roofs it was a match for Rome. What is more, it was famous for its two churches. One of these, built in honour of the martyr Julius, was graced by a choir of most lovely virgins dedicated to God. The second, founded in the name of the blessed Aaron, the companion of Julius, was served by a monastery of canons and counted as the third metropolitan see of Britain. The city also contained a college of 200 learned men who were skilled in astronomy and the other arts, and who watched with great attention the courses of the stars, and so, by their careful computations, prophesied for King Arthur any prodigies due at that time. It was this city, therefore, famous for such a wealth of pleasant things, which was made ready for the feast. Messengers were sent to the different kingdoms, and invitations were delivered to all those who were due to come to the court from the various parts of Gaul, and from the nearby islands in the sea. The following people came. Augustulus, king of Albany, which is now known as Scotland. Urien, king of the men of Moray. Cadwallo Lur, king of the Venedotai, who are now called the North Welsh. Stator, king of the Domiti, now the South Welsh. And Cador, king of Cornwall. There came too the archbishops of the three metropolitan sees, London, York, and Dubricius from the city of the legions. The last named, who was the primate of Britain and legate of the papal see, was so remarkably pious that by merely praying he could cure anyone who was ill. The leading men from the principal cities were there: Morvid, Earl of Gloucester, Moron, Earl of Worcester, Anaruth, Earl of Salisbury, Artgulcar, Earl of Gerensis, which is now called Warwick, Eugain from Leicester, Cursalem from Caister, Kinark, Duke of Durabernia, Urbgenius from Bath, Jonathel of Dorchester, and Bosso of Riddachen, that is, Oxford. In addition to these great leaders, there came other famous men of equal importance: Donort Map Papo, Hennes Map Coil, Peridur, Map Peridur, Grifford, Map Nugord, Regin, Map Clout, Edelui, Map Oledoak, Kenar, Map Bangham, Kinmarok, Gorbonian, Map Gwait, Warloit, Run, Map Neton, Kimberlin, Edonalth, Map Strunat, Cathlus, Map Cathel, Cunlit, Map Teton, and many others whose names it is too tedious to tell. Gilmarius, king of Ireland, came from the neighbouring islands, with Malvasius, king of Iceland, Doldavius, king of Gotland, Gompar, king of the Orkneys, Loth, king of Norway, and Achkil, king of the Danes. From lands across the sea came Haldin, the leader of the Ruteni, Leodegarius, earl of Holland, Bedivere, the cupbearer, who was the duke of Normandy, Borellus of Kenemania, Kay the Senescal, who was the Duke of Anjou, Guittard of Poitou, and the 12 peers from the various regions of Gaul, led by Gerin of Chartres, and then Hoel, leader of the Armorican Britons, with the princes who did him homage. All these marched with a train of accoutrements, mules, and horses, such as I find it hard to describe. Once they are listed, there remained no prince of any distinction this side of Spain who did not come when he received his invitation. There was nothing remarkable in this, for Arthur's generosity was known throughout the whole world, and this made all men love him. Finally, when they had all assembled in the town, and the time of the feast had come, the archbishops were led forward to the palace, so that they could place the royal crown upon the king's head. Since the plenary court was being held in his own diocese, Dubricius made ready to sing mass in celebration of the moment when the king should place the crown upon his head. As soon as the king was enrobed, he was conducted with due pomp to the church of the metropolitan see. On his right side, and on his left, There were two archbishops to support him. Four kings of Albany, Cornwall, Demetia, and Venedotia preceded him, as was their right, bearing before him four golden swords. A company of clerics of every rank advanced before him, chanting in exquisite harmony. From another direction, the archbishops and bishops led the queen, adorned with her own regalia, to the church of the dedicated virgins. Before her walked the four consorts of the kings already mentioned, carrying four white doves according to the custom. All the married women present followed behind her with great rejoicing. Afterwards, when the procession was over, so much organ music was played in the two churches, and the choir sang so sweetly that, because of the high standard of the music offered, the knights who were there hardly knew which of the churches to enter first. They flocked in crowds, first to this one, then to the other, so that if the whole day had been spent in celebration, they would not have been bored. Finally, high mass was celebrated in both churches. The king and the queen then took off their crowns and put on lighter regalia. The king went off with the men to feast in his own palace, and the queen retired with the married women to feast in hers. For the Britons still observed the ancient custom of Troy, the men celebrating festive occasions with their fellow men, and the women eating separately with the other women. When they were all seated, as the rank of each decreed, Kay, the seneschal, robed in ermine and assisted by 1,000 noblemen, who were all clad in ermine too, bore in the food. The same number of men, clad this time in miniver, followed Bedivere the cupbearer from another entrance, helping him to pass drinks of all sorts in goblets of every conceivable shape. Meanwhile, in the queen's palace, innumerable servants dressed in varying liveries were performing their duties, each according to his office. If I were to describe everything, I should make this story far too long. Indeed, by this time, Britain had reached such a standard of sophistication that it excelled all other kingdoms in its general affluence, the richness of its decorations, and the courteous behaviour of its inhabitants. Every knight in the country, who was in any way famed for his bravery, wore livery and arms showing his own distinctive colour, and women of fashion often displayed the same colours. They scorned to give their love to any man who had not proved himself three times in battle. In this way, the womenfolk became chaste and more virtuous, and for their love the knights were ever more daring. Invigorated by the food and drink which they had consumed, they went out into the meadows outside the city and split up into groups ready to play various games. The knights planned an imitation battle and competed together on horseback, while their womenfolk watched from the top of the city walls and aroused them to passionate excitement by their flirtatious behaviour. The others passed what remained of the day in shooting with bows and arrows, hurling the lance, tossing heavy stones and rocks, playing dice, and an immense variety of other games. This without the slightest show of ill feeling. Whoever won his particular game was then rewarded by Arthur with an immense prize. The next 3 days were passed in this way. On the fourth day, all those who in the office which they held had done Arthur any service were called together, and each rewarded with a personal grant of cities, castles, archbishoprics, bishoprics, and other landed possessions. Then the saintly Dubricius, who for a long time had wanted to live as a hermit, resigned from his position as archbishop. David, the king's uncle, whose way of life had afforded an example of unblemished virtue to those whom he had instructed in the faith, was consecrated in his place. At the same time, Tibaus, the celebrated priest of Llandaff, was appointed in the place of the holy Samson, Archbishop of Dol. This, with the approval of Hoel, king of the Armorican Britons, to whom Tibaus' life and saintly habits had commended him. The bishopric of Silchester was given to Morganius, that of Winchester to Divanius, and that of Alclud to Elidenius. While Arthur was distributing these benefices among his clergy, 12 men of mature years and respectable appearance came marching in at a slow pace. In their right hands, they carried olive branches to show that they were envoys. They saluted Arthur and handed to him a communication from Lucius Hiberius, and this letter read as follows. Lucius, Procurator of the Republic, wishes that Arthur, King of Britain, may receive such treatment as he has deserved. I am amazed at the insolent way in which you continue your tyrannical behaviour. I am even more amazed at the damage which you have done to Rome. When I think about it, I am outraged that you should have so far forgotten yourself as not to realise this, and not to appreciate immediately what it means that by your criminal behaviour you should have insulted the Senate, to which the entire world owes submission, as you very well know. You have had the presumption to disobey this mighty empire by holding back the tribute of Britain, which tribute the Senate has ordered you to pay, seeing that Gaius Julius Caesar and other men of high place in the Roman state had received it for many years. You have torn Gaul away from that empire. You have seized the province of the Allobroges, and you have laid hands on all the islands of the ocean, the kings of which paid tribute to my ancestors from the first moment when the might of Rome prevailed in those regions. As a result, the Senate has decreed that punishment should be exacted for this long series of wrongs which you have done. I therefore order you to appear in Rome, so that you may submit yourself to your overlords and suffer the penalty of whatever sentence they may pass, and I appoint the middle of next August as the time for your coming. If you fail to arrive, I shall invade your territory myself and do my best to restore to the Roman state all that you have taken from it by your insane behaviour. This letter was read aloud in the presence of the kings and the leaders. Arthur then withdrew with them to a gigantic tower near the entrance to the palace to consider what ought to be done in the face of such a message. As they began to climb the stairs, Cador, Duke of Cornwall, who was a merry man, burst out laughing. "Until now," he said to the king, "I have been afraid that the life of ease which the Britons have been leading might make cowards of them and soften them up during this long spell of peace. Their reputation for bravery on the battlefield, for which they are more famous than any other people, might well have been completely lost to them. Indeed, when it is obvious that men are no longer using their weapons, but are instead playing at dice, burning up their strength with women, and indulging in other gratifications of that sort, then without any doubt, their bravery, honour, courage, and good name all become tainted with cowardice. For the past 5 years or thereabouts, we have thought of nothing but these follies, and we have had no battle experience. It is precisely to free us from this sloth that God has stirred up the resentment of the Romans, so that they may restore our courage to what it used to be in the old days." As Cador was saying this to them, and much more in the same strain, they reached their seats. When all had sat down, Arthur made the following speech. "You, who have been my companions in good times and in bad, you, of whose fortitude, both in giving advice and in waging war, I have had ample proof in the past, give me now your closest attention, every one of you, and in your wisdom, tell me what you consider we should do on receiving such a letter as this. Anything which has been planned with great care by man in his wisdom is realized the more easily when the time for action arrives. It follows that we shall be able to bear this attack of Lucius with great equanimity if we have first of all worked out with one accord how we are best to resist him. For myself, I do not consider that we ought to fear his coming very much, seeing with what a trumped-up case he is demanding the tribute which he wants to exact from Britain. He says that he ought to be given it because it used to be paid to Julius Caesar and those who succeeded him, When these men landed with their armed band and conquered our fatherland by force and violence at a time when it was weakened by civil dissensions, they had been encouraged to come here by the disunity of our ancestors. Seeing that they seized the country in this way, it was wrong of them to exact tribute from it. Nothing that is acquired by force and violence can ever be held legally by anyone. Insofar as the Romans have done us violence, he pleads an unreasonable case when he maintains that we are his tributaries in the eyes of the law. Since he presumes to exact something illegal from us, let us, by a similar argument, seek from him the tribute of Rome. Let him who comes out on top carry off what he has made up his mind to take. If the Roman decrees that tribute ought to be paid him by Britain, simply because Julius Caesar and other Roman leaders conquered this country years ago, then I decree in the same way that Rome ought to give me tribute in that my ancestors once captured that city. Belinus, that most glorious of the kings of the Britons, with the help of his brother Brennius, the Duke of the Albigenses, hanged 20 of the noblest Romans in the middle of their own forum, captured the city, and when they had occupied it, held it for a long time. Similarly, Constantine, the son of Helen, and Maximianus too, both of them close relations of mine, wearing the crown of Britain, one after the other, each gained the throne of Imperial Rome. Do you not agree, then, that it is we who should demand tribute of Rome? As for Gaul and the neighbouring islands of the ocean, we need send no answer, for when we snatched those lands from their empire, they made no effort to defend them. As soon as Arthur had finished his address, Hwel, king of the Armorican Britons, was told to speak first in reply. Even if every one of us, said he, were to take the trouble to turn all these things over in his mind and to reconsider each point deep within himself, it is my opinion that no one could find better advice to give than what has just emerged from your own experienced and highly skilled wisdom. Your speech, adorned as it was with Ciceronian eloquence, has anticipated exactly what we all think. We should have nothing but unstinting praise for the opinion expressed by so steadfast a man as you, for the strength of so wise a mind, the benefit of such excellent counsel. If you are prepared to set out for Rome in such a cause as this, then I have no doubt at all about our being victorious. We shall be defending our liberty, when in all justice we demand from our enemies what they have sought from us in the first place. Whoever tries to steal from another the things which are that other's may justly lose to the other whom he is attacking the things which belong to him personally. Since the Romans propose to remove from us that which is our own, without any doubt at all, we, on the contrary, shall take from them what is theirs. That is, if we once have a chance of meeting them in battle. Such a confrontation is longed for by all Britons. Do not the Sibylline prophecies testify in verse that for the third time someone born of British blood shall seize the Empire of Rome? As far as the first two are concerned, the prophecies are already fulfilled, for it is well known, as you yourself have said, that those famous princes, Belinus and Constantine, once won the imperial crown of Rome. Now we have you as the third man, to whom the supreme dignity of such an honour is promised. Make haste, then, to take in your hand what God is only too willing to bestow. Hasten to conquer that which in itself is ripe for the conquering. Hasten to exalt us all, for we shall not shrink from being wounded or even losing our lives if it leads to your being exalted. In order that you may accomplish this, I shall stand at your side with 10,000 armed men. When Hwel had finished speaking, Augustulus, the king of Albany, began in the following words to declare what he thought about this. From the moment when I realized that my lord really meant what he has said, such joy entered my heart as I cannot describe in his presence. If the Romans and the Germans remain unscathed, and we fail to take vengeance on them, like true men, for the slaughter they have in the past inflicted upon our fellow countrymen, then we seem to have achieved nothing at all in the past campaigns which we have waged against so many mighty kings. Now that the opportunity is promised us of meeting them in battle, I am overwhelmed with joy, and only too eager for the day on which we shall come together. I thirst for their blood, as I would thirst for a spring if I had been prevented from drinking for 3 whole days. If only I may live to see that day. How sweet will be the wounds which I shall give and receive once we come together hand to hand. Death itself will be sweet, if only I may suffer it in avenging our ancestors, safeguarding our liberty, and exalting our king. Let us attack these emasculated creatures. Let us attack again and again, so that when we have crushed them, we may seize all their possessions and rejoice in our victory. For my part, I will augment our army to the tune of 2,000 armed knights, not counting the infantry that go with them. It remained only for the others to say what still needed to be said. One after the other, they promised Arthur as many men as they owed him as their feudal service. In addition to those whom the Armorican leader had promised, 60,000 armed men were mustered from the island of Britain alone. The kings of the other islands, who had not yet developed the habit of using cavalry, promised as many foot soldiers as each man owed, so that from the 6 islands of Ireland, Iceland, Gotland, the Orkneys, Norway, and Denmark, 120,000 men were counted. From the various duchies of Gaul, those of the Ruteni, the Portovenses, the Normans, the Cenomani, the Angevins, and the Poitevins came 80,000. And from the 12 independent territories, of those who accompanied Gerin of Chartres, came another 1,200. The total number of the entire army, not including the foot soldiers, who were not at all easy to count, was therefore 183,300. When King Arthur saw that they were all ready to enter his service, he accepted their offer and ordered them to return home immediately and assemble the troops which they had promised. He also instructed them to rendezvous at the port of Barfleur, and then to be ready to march with him to the lands of the Allobroges, where they would meet the Romans. Finally, he sent word to the emperors by their own messengers to say that he had no intention whatsoever of paying them tribute, and that he was certainly not coming to Rome in order to receive their legal decision in this matter. He was coming, on the contrary, to exact from them what they had decreed in their own judicial sentence that they would demand from him. The messengers set out. At the same time, the kings and princes left for home, determined to waste no time in carrying out what they had been ordered to do.
An alternative.